gonna talk a little bit about the involvement of symbiotic bacteria in the transmission of tomato yellow leaf curl virus. This is the pest, Bimisia tabaci, and it's a very important pest worldwide, and in our region especially it's very important because it causes lots of damages.
In 1990, where they studied the invasion of polygon colony.
Leishmania was an appropriate thing that should be studied. It was introduced as one of these old diseases that really may not have too much implications anymore. Since that time, we've learned that this is not the case. But here's depicted in an artifact that is quite old, and then also a very similar lesion in a child with Leishmania major. When we look at Leishmania, there's over 350 million people at risk. And in terms of human suffering and economics, it's second only to malaria as far as protozoans are concerned. It's endemic in 22 New World countries and 66 Old World countries. We've talked a lot already about the clinical forms that people have talked about, so I will move on to that. This is a global distribution of visceral leishmaniasis. At this point, and this is pretty much for humans, the U.S. is not included in that, but with some of the studies that we did starting in 66, there is a lot of visceral leishmaniasis in the U.S., only at this point it's in dogs. There it is. So in the eastern part of the states here, there's actually quite an abundance of leishmaniasis in dogs. This is a distribution of cutaneous leishmaniasis, and you see we do have some of the New World cutaneous leishmaniasis transmission occurring in Texas. Now, I want to move on to leishmaniasis in Iraq. Again, these are the kinds of leishmania that are there. We have both visceral and cutaneous occurring in Iraq. This shows the distribution from sort of a historical standpoint, although I know that a lot of the cutaneous cases that came back with soldiers actually occurred more in this part of Iraq, which has been mapped in the past, so it's quite a bit more widespread through the country than appears here. So the incidence of leishmaniasis in the U.S. soldiers deployed actually turned out to be quite high during the second Gulf War. And these are the numbers. And these are numbers are probably a little bit low because these are actually confirmed parasitology cases that were taken and treated at the hospital. But as you see, there were more than 1,200 cases that were confirmed, most of those occurring in the Army. This shows the incidence by year, and we had many, many more cases occurring in the first part of the conflict. I guess I shouldn't call it a conflict, but and then they dropped off quite significantly, and probably the most important factor in this drop-off was the introduction of air conditioning into the soldier sleeping quarters. These are the cases from the first ODS, and we had 20 cases of viscerotropic cases, and these were identified from the bone marrow. There was no lesions or anything that appeared on these soldiers, just parasites isolated from the bone marrow. And then we also had some cases involving the true visceral disease. So far there have been 4 cases. But most of the cases have come from Leishmania major are the cutaneous cases. So this brings up the concern with over 1,200 cases of, and probably closer to 2,000 cases returning to the U.S., is there a risk of this parasite, of this leishmania, being transmitted to other people in the U.S.? In considering this, we want to take a look at the life cycle or the epidemiology of leishmania. We have an enzootic infection where it's maintained in the reservoir and passed from reservoir to reservoir by the sandfly. And then when a human sort of comes in and gets bitten by some of these infected flies, they pick up the parasite. This is the zoonotic case, and this is a case with most cutaneous leishmaniasis. And then sometimes we can have an anthraponotic transmission. Generally, this is considered not to occur with cutaneous leishmaniasis. Okay, it does occur with some of the visceral kinds, but a lot of these studies have been done in areas where there is so much reservoir transmission going on. I'm not sure that we would be able to identify a autogenous case or not if it did occur. So if we want to set up the conditions that are necessary for transmission, we need a source of the parasites. We need a suitable vector for the parasite or the disease. There needs to be contact between the disease source and the vector, and then contact between the vector and the new host. And if we want to carry this farther, besides just localized transmission, which may happen and has happened with malaria at airports and things like this, if we want to think about the possibility of this becoming an emerging disease in a particular area, besides a suitable vector, we need a sympatric distribution between a reservoir. We need a suitable reservoir in the area and vectors. And the vector only occasionally really needs to come in contact with man for this to happen. Okay, the source of the disease. Okay, we've talked about this already, and this is, in this case, returning soldiers. Most of the soldiers coming back, as I mentioned, were cases of Leishmania major. This individual here, this is actually not Leishmania, but this is typifies the biting intensity of the sandflies that some of these guys were exposed to, which was really quite intense. Now, these are some of the cases of soldiers, the types of Leishmania they brought back. Lesions were on most of the exposed parts of the body, on the hands, the face, the ears, the legs, the arms, and some of these were actually very aggressive, as can be seen here. The next thing we want to talk about is the possibility of contact between the disease source of these soldiers coming back and the vector, or is there a vector in the States? As has been pointed out, phlebotomy is the only proven vector of sandflies, and they pick up the parasites from macrophages. They develop infections in the gut. Then they bite the host and transmit the disease. As far as mammalian feeding species of sandflies in the U.S., we've identified four at this point. Leuchsomyia anthophora, which is mainly a rodent feeder. It will occasionally feed on a man or a higher animal. But most of the times they feed on rodents. Leuchsomyia diabolica is an avid mammalian feeder, will feed on people without too much reluctance. Leuchsomyia cruciata is sort of isolated to a small part of Florida, Georgia area, not very widespread. And then Leuchsomyia shannoni, which turns out to be actually quite widespread, particularly in the East. And with some of the work that's been done here, we've identified it even into Texas. Go through of the life cycle. Larvae hatch out from eggs in about a week after they're laid. The larvae go through four instars, takes about 4 weeks or 6 weeks, depending on temperature, for this to develop into pupae. This is actually Leuchsomyia shannoni larvae, and this is one of the pupae, kind of reddish. The fourth instars clear their guts, pupate. We have adults emerging. The life cycle takes about 4 to 8 weeks, depending on the temperature. And this shows the distribution of the sandflies that we have in the United States, of mammalian feeding sandflies. Some of the non-mammalian feeding go farther north, but as far as up into New Jersey and down into Florida and over into Alabama and Mississippi. And then as we've actually found some shannoni in some of our collections in Texas. So it goes over into Texas now. The purple here is cruciata, which is localized to this area. Probably not much of a vector, at least it's not been incriminated in Central and South America. And then we have anthophora and diabolica here in Texas, which is heavily involved in the transmission of cutaneous leishmaniasis in Texas. This is a picture of the female and the male Leuchsomyia shannoni. Most of the work that's been done on Leuchsomyia shannoni has come out of Ossabaw Island. This is the work of Brinson and Comer, and they show the distribution mainly from April to December. You get pretty good numbers of shannoni on the island. This graph here from Comer shows the kind of habitat. They generally like live oak, but you also can get them from mixed pine and pine areas. Traditionally, live oak was considered their main habitat, but as we continue to learn more and more about this fly, we find that it actually has quite varied habitat, and you can find it in these other areas. In Alabama, where I collect at Fort Rucker, my best area is not the hardwood habitat, but the pine habitat. So it does adapt to and develop in other habitats. As we look at this map of collections from Shannon and I from North Carolina, I actually got what the mosquito people call the trash, the bycatch from their traps, and looked for Shannon and sandflies in it. And actually we found it from the coast all the way up to the mountains in various places, so it's actually quite widespread. So the two bases that we looked at in this study were Fort Campbell and Fort Hood. We also looked at Fort Bragg, but we haven't got the data analyzed for that yet. So these are the Shannon I collected from traps from these areas. We use mainly the spermatheca to identify the males or the females, and then the head also is involved a little bit. The males are a little easier to identify by the external genitalia. And this is the graph of the sandflies collected from Fort Campbell. Most of them are Shannoni. The distribution is from July through September, October, in that time frame. It's a little cooler there than it would be in Ospa Island, so the period of time that they're active is a bit less. And this is for 2007. The other site was Fort Hood, and this is in Texas, where previously Shannon I was not thought to exist. The sites that we collected at were around Ballora or Benton Lake, and this is where a lot of soldiers go for recreation and camping and so on. These are some of the sites from Fort Hood that